He was an inspiration to me then. I appreciated the things he had to share, and I hope that he can touch your lives. I'm going to bring you Johnny H.
Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here this morning and sober. If there are any new people in Alcoholics Anonymous here this morning, I hope the word being sober doesn't offend you as bad as it offended me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I sat in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on first Sunday, November 1959, and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous talked to me about being sober, I didn't think they had anything to offer me. And the reason I didn't think that is because I was as physically sober when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as I am right now. Just physically sober. And that had always been my problem. If I could have stayed loaded forever, I'd have never came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I kept getting interrupted out there on my happy road of destiny. And the sum total of it is that I had to come here. And I hope that you stay around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to understand what we mean when we talk about being sober, as opposed to what the world thinks when they talk to us about being sober. Because I've come to understand it's an entirely different concept of what you're talking about. You see, I lived a certain way for a long period of time, and for a long period of time couldn't stay sober. Couldn't stay sober. Couldn't stay out of trouble. I have lived an entirely different way for an entirely different period of time, and for all that length of time it hasn't been necessary for me to drink anything, swallow anything, smoke anything, or stick anything in my arm for almost 29 years now. And for that I'm extremely grateful. So if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I urge you to stay until the initial shock of that wears off of you. Now, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always considered it some type of a privilege to be allowed to even attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, just to be able to go in and sit down and enjoy the fellowship and the atmosphere of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always considered it some type of a privilege I have no right to have. And when I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's even more of a privilege, no matter what it is. And so I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very appreciative of the committee. Now, I'm extremely pleased to be here this morning, fully clothed and in my right mind. Now, I tell you that not because of any reason, but the fact that the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 29 years ago right now. I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary barking at the moon. And because of a loving God has expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. If I get nothing out of this deal at all, nothing at all, I could live with that all the way home. It makes me feel good. I'd like to be able to stand here this morning or at any podium anywhere in the world that anybody will listen to me and be able to say to them without any type of reservation whatsoever that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. Oh, I would love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find you. That's all. You see, I've always been an emotional misfit. I never belonged anywhere. I don't know why that was. I was always restless and irritable and discontent, but I didn't know that was symptoms of my illness. I was bitter and hostile and angry, and I don't know where that came from. I've always felt that way. I didn't like where I was, who I was, who I was around. I hated everything that moved. And I don't know why that was. I don't, just did. And I had excuses. Everybody's got excuses. You know, if you're selfish and self-centered, you've always got excuses. It's their fault. It's my fault. And I had excuses. I had drunken people. Everybody in my family were drunks. My mother was a drunk. My father was a drunk. I had four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. So I said to myself, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are bad people. I don't belong around them. So I started looking around for where I belong. And wherever I looked. See, I believe this. I believed I was born needing an answer. I was born without an answer. I didn't know what the questions were, but I was born without the answer. I didn't know what it was. I was always on this search for something, so I started looking around, and whatever I saw and heard was confusing to me. I saw things that I didn't understand, that I understood, but the answer was confusing when I heard this. Now, see, my family, being the way they were, they used to gather up on the weekends and beat each other half to death. That was their deal. They gathered up and whipped on one another, stole each other's whiskey and each other's women, and I guess whoever survived that week was the king. I don't know. I don't know how they worked it out, but they had kind of a little deal there, I guess. And I could understand that. I can understand that. If you're full of anger and bitterness, you can understand violence. Kicking somebody. You know, it's almost like a spiritual experience. You know what I mean? It makes you feel good all over. It just runs all up to you. You can understand that. Now, the thing that confused me more than anything else was not what they did, but what they said. Because along about Wednesdays and Thursdays, they put their arms around one another and said to them, to each other, "We love one another because we're family." And I guess, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I guess I said to myself, if that's what love is, you can keep it. I don't need it. Because I don't ever remember, ever in my lifetime, prior to coming into a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, ever uttering the word love. I never said it to another human being who lived upon the face of this earth. And the reason I didn't say it is because I'm selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, and self-serving. I'm a user and a taker of things. And if I told you that I loved you, you had an edge. And I spent my entire lifetime prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous not giving anybody an edge. Not showing any type of weaknesses, but yet I was so weak it scared me to death. And that's the way I lived all my life. I didn't know that. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand anything that was going on. I was confused, so I started looking for a way out. I went places. I had a grandmother who didn't drink. My grandmother lived, she was 90 years old and she didn't drink. I remember being in the kitchen with my grandmother while these crazy people are down there killing one another. Grandma just wandered around the kitchen singing songs to Jesus, you know. Yes, Jesus loved me. You know, here come one of them flying through the kitchen, you know. Grandma just step over him and say, "Yes, Jesus loves you." You know, just having a And I thought, God, that's wonderful. I must be like Grandma. So I went where Grandma went. And I went Grandma. Grandma went to this place called church. And I went with Grandma. I remember how excited I was. See, I never figured on one simple little thing all my life. Wherever I went, I went. I know that's kind of deep, but try to hang on to it a little bit if you can. I don't want to pass you by too much over there. But I just took this rotten attitude, this rotten feeling, this bitterness, this hostility, this arrogance, this feeling of difference, and I took it over and sat down in this place. And I sit back there, waited, while this man got up at a rostrum on Sunday morning, very much like this, got his long flowing robe with his air of authority, and I sit there wondering and waiting for him to tell me what was wrong with me. And even more important than that, I guess I wanted him to tell me what to do about it. And what he said to me was that I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, "You're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters." And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for a reason I didn't even understand. God, I felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in that church a long time ago. The people are going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I got ready and walked out the side of that church that day, and my old man standing there drunk and hungover, and he tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." I don't know what that did for my old man, but I haven't been back to church since. And it really hasn't got anything to do with church. It's got a lot to do with me. See, I lived in a house where these drunks worked, and I don't know whether you've ever lived in a house where there were two drunks. It's a frightening place for little kids. In the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silent. Every once in a while, the old man come got me and started kicking me around. He didn't do it to my brothers. He did it to me. I remember laying there when they were gone, which is the most terrifying time. And they're out there somewhere. And I'm laying there with my thoughts, and I'm thinking about all these things that go on in my life. I'm thinking about my uncles who live in penitentiaries. I think about my aunts who work in those houses on the other side of the track. I think about my grandfather who burns down barns, my old man who beats up my mother, my mother who beats up my old man. I think about all them kind of things. And somewhere back there in my mind, it dawns on me what the problem is. It's alcohol. They drink, these people, and these those things. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something. And I'm going to be something. What do you do if you're weird? I tell you what I did. I took a drink. It wasn't any big decision on my part. I just got into my old man's bootleg hooch one day and took a drink of alcohol. And it was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. I spent the next 20 years of my life pursuing that feeling into the gates of insanity and death and beyond. Compromising every principle, everything that I ever had. No task was too dirty. No penalty too severe. Nothing was too outrageous for me to try to get that feeling back inside me when I had my first drink. Never was alcohol that was the feeling. Because that feeling went down inside of me and tore that madness from me. It took me from the black pit of nothingness and stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living and installed in me a sense of arrogance and said, damn you, world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. And I'll tell you a very strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or use drugs anymore, they don't work. They quit working a long time ago. Matter of fact, they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. And that's the type of hell I never want to have to live in ever again. And what happened to me when I drank alcohol happened to me every time I drank alcohol. It never changed. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath the bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol, they pulled me out of a car and constantly stood me in front of a judge and sent me to 20 years in the penitentiary. That's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. I traveled around. I went from reform school to reform school to junior penitentiaries to nut houses. Oh, nut houses. There's a boon to all mankind in nut houses. I was sitting at banquet last night thinking about that. We used to have things similar to that in the nut house on Saturday night. We'd have a meal. Then we'd have a little therapy and a dance. Very much like we had last night, you know what I mean? Things hadn't changed much, I guess. You know? And at that particular time in my life, they were teaching me better living through electricity. And wait till I die, you'll really get a kick out of that one. I'll just put you into hysterics. But they used to take Saturdays. It seemed like Saturdays, that's when they took their, that's when they had me scheduled for treatment. And by the time I got around to the dance, I'd be leaning up against the wall. And what happens when they give you better living through electricity? They shock you senseless for about 3 days. You don't remember much anything. You just lose track of things. Along about the third day, you're starting to come to again, and you remember what they did to you, and you get angry about that. You know? So you attack another psychiatrist when he asks you how you're doing, and they do it all over again. It's just... But anyhow, on Saturday night, I'd be leaning up against the wall, very much like any AA dance that you go to. And we had co-educational dances, and here she'd come. You know, I mean, she'd shuffle over, and you'd watch her. You know, they treated her that day, too. And we would engage in meaningful conversation, you know. And finally, we'd be able to get the big question out of there. She'd say, what's your name? I'd show her my little band because I didn't know who I was. And you know what separates me from that? You know what separates me just from leaning up against a wall somewhere with my mind shocked senseless? And attending a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Flint, Michigan in 1988. You know what separates me from that? Just a thought. Just one thought. I'm different. I don't have to do this anymore. I put in my time. I can sit back and rest on my laurels. I'm not like those other people anymore. I don't have to go to 5 or 6 or 7 meetings a week. I don't have to be sponsored. I don't have to sponsor people. I don't have to do these things anymore. time for me to sit back and rest on my laurels. I can show up once a year and take my cake. That's all. Thank God that because of strong sponsorship in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not allowed to sink into that type of complacency, which would kill me. I'm sitting on a furlough from a reform school when I'm 10 or 11 years old and alcohol quit working in my life. It's the most frightening thing I can remember of, because I remember sitting around worrying about that, wondering about putting that seal of that baby up inside of me when I got down in this furlough. And I drank a whole gallon of wine that time, and I sit there sober as I am right now, frightened to death. My magic wasn't magic anymore. Guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't you try these?" And he gave me some pills. I don't remember saying to him, "What are those? Will they bother me if I take them?" I just thank God they weren't X-lax. That's all I can say. Now, we could start a whole new 12-step program called Laxative Anonymous on that. I could be standing up here this morning and saying, "I'm a dull child of a laxative taker." I would have been functional, but Mom was on the toilet all the time. It's kind of bizarre, isn't it? Not much more bizarre than some of the stuff I hear. All I can tell you is it worked, that's all. It did it. It created that feeling. It made it bearable for me to live in a world I didn't understand for just an instant. It run remorse. It erased me from me. It took away the memories. Sitting on a furlough from a reform school, a couple of years later, I'm eating pills and drinking wine and nothing's working, and a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, running in and out of institutions. Living out there in them streets where people like me live, doing the things that people like me do in them streets. Ripping and running and roaring and using and abusing. That's what I did. I'm a taker. If you had something I wanted, I took it. When I took everything and used up everything you had, I threw you away like so much garbage with no thought, no conscious concern, no feeling about anything or any other human being on the face of the earth, only my own comfort. That's all I was interested in, always, just trying to get this madness out from inside of me. And whatever it took, fine. Whatever the penalty was, so what? No penalty was too severe. The penalty of feeling that way was much more severe than the consequences I had to face because I searched out that feeling and accumulated it. And for lack of a better word, that is a disease called alcoholism. And that only happens to alcoholics like me when we're sober. I spent every waking moment of my life trying to keep from being sober. Because the moment I was sober, I was faced with me. I was faced with the things that I'd done and the harm that I created and the things that went on in my life. In 1951, I stood in the old Los Angeles County Jail where my mother screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. My 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison, took an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that. I handled like I handled most things. I got angry about it, made it go away. I stood handcuffed between two detectives 3 days later while they buried my baby brother. I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I'd like to have cried, but I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. The reason I didn't have because I didn't think they were necessary. I went on to the penitentiary, and I spent the next 4.5 years of my life in the penitentiary. Trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, "Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution." He took me down and showed me a little green room. He says, "You're going to end up here, hotshot." And I told him, "Not me. I'm different. I'm different." I come walking out of that institution bound and determined. I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laying in the nut house kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the country, interviewing psychiatrists. Well, I used to interview them. I sat there with my wraparound overcoat on and talked to them. Did you ever try to attack the psychiatrist in a straitjacket? Doesn't work. We sit there and he talked to me about my mother and I talked to him about his mother. That's when he introduced me to better living through electricity. You know, when I was a kid in reform school, I sit down across the table from these counselors. I sit down across the desk from some of the finest minds in the field of psychiatry this world knows anything about. I sit down across the table from some of the finest criminologists that this world has ever seen, some of the finest penologists, some of the finest religious leaders. I sent out across the table from all them people. When I was a kid in reform school, I sent out across these people, and what they said to me, "Johnny, if you didn't drink, you'd be all right." When I'm in junior reform schools, they said, "Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things, shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems." In my last engagement in a nut house in a federal government hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, I sit across the table with one of the finest minds in the field of psychiatry the federal government knows anything about. He looked at me and he said, "Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things, shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems." You know what none of those people ever took into consideration? Every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am right now. As physically sober. How I wanted to scream out at them, "Don't you understand? Good God, don't you understand? Make it 1950 again, and I won't have to do this anymore. Make it 1950 when my baby brother and I are playing on the sand and riding around in my big automobile with a pocket full of money and a closet full of $300 suits. Bring it back to 1950 again. I won't have to do this anymore. Take all the faces of the people that I'd harmed and the things I'd done. Take those away from me. Replace those again. I won't do this no more. Take this madness from inside of me. I won't ever have to put that other stuff in me." But I didn't know that, because I hadn't been here. Hadn't been anywhere. My idea was that the conversation, I got on a Greyhound bus and went back to Los Angeles to kill myself. Because you see, when an alcoholic no longer has an answer, his idea is to kill himself. That's the answer to the alcoholic, death. When the answer is no longer the answer, it's easier. It happens to an alcoholic all the time. They either die, they go insane, or they get sober and stay sober. They don't have any consequences about it. And the sad thing I know about the disease of alcoholism is that alcoholics kill themselves cold sober. That's when alcoholics commit suicide, not drunk. They commit suicide cold sober because they cannot stand living, I guess. I couldn't stand it. I came back to kill myself. Because they proved to me without a shadow of a doubt how unique I was. There wasn't anybody else upon the face of the earth like me. A little over 30 years ago, in January, they tied me down to bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow, and a doctor stood at the foot of my bed and told me I was going to die. She said, "Son, you're going to die and nothing we can do for you." And I said, "Okay." All day passed and all night passed. He come wandering back into my room the next morning. He looked down at my bed. He said, "Son, you're going to die and nothing we can do for you." I said, "Okay." The third day he came into my room, I had a terror grip me that I have never known before since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again, and God knows I didn't want to do that anymore. I lay in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, "Oh, God, help me." I thought for a long, long time nothing had happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an AA meeting down there." I just went to sleep for a little while. And I don't know how many have ever kicked a two-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. That's the first time I'd been asleep in a long time. I tell you how sick I was. 2 weeks. 2 short weeks after I screamed out that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up running around in jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I'd just gotten off of. See, in the back of my mind, where my problem centers, was an idea that once upon a time, I couldn't stand it any longer. I could ingest something into my system that made it all right for just a while. And even though it wasn't working anymore, and I knew it wasn't working anymore, I knew it would if I could just find the right combination. It's the only thing that had ever worked in my life. It has to work again. Sooner or later, it has to. I stood in front of a Superior Court judge and was sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. I was called a blood-sucking parasite of society. There was a woman sitting in the courtroom who was carrying my child, and the judge said to her, if she cared anything at all about the child she carried inside of her, that I'd never be allowed to lay eyes on it. And you know what? The judge didn't say anything that I didn't know. That's the first time I'd ever heard it. I've always known what I was. Always. I always knew that I crawled out from underneath a rock. I always knew that I was a taker and a user and abuser. I've always known that. As I stand before you this morning, I know exactly what I am. I don't have to be judged. I've judged me harsher than anybody's ever judged me. I judge me and condemn me to death time and time and time again for my crimes against humanity and the people about me. I know all about that kind of torture of the damned. The evidence of that man's statement was that I thought now everybody knew it. So I spent the next 9 months of my life crawling around in that cell in San Quentin barking at the moon. On the first Sunday in November 1959, I wandered into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober, because I was sober. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was an alcoholic. Matter of fact, if I'd have known where I was coming on that Sunday in November, I wouldn't even have come. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because the institution I was in let women come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around ever since. You got to be careful what gets us weakos in here. I'll tell you. You open up the door and let some of us bent fenders are going to walk through the door. I'll tell you. Just, you never know. You can't tell. You know, it'd be fun. If you sit at the door and you watch all the people come in and say, he'll make it, he'll make it, he won't. You'll never know. I remember my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous like this. I hope I never forget it. Because there's a passage that was written by a very wise man a long time ago and said, anything that you forget, you're condemned to relive. And I never want to forget my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I never want another first one. I remember sitting in the back row, moving in, sitting down in the back row. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. Remember looking up on the backboard, I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know what A was. I said to this clown sitting next to me, what is this? He says, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or Over-Hip Anonymous or Doo-Doos, any kind of an anonymous, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. So I thought to myself, well, I'll wait for these women to tell their racist stories. And I don't know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't very many young, pretty girls in Alcoholics Anonymous. There just wasn't. And these old gals got up to talk that morning, and they said that they drank for a long time. You could look at them and know they'd been somewhere for a long time. They didn't have to tell you they drank. You knew they drank. They said, I drank. And I said, I bet you did, Mama. Bad stuff, too. I mean, that's the way I was. I just, my attitude. But there was something about those people. Even where I was sitting, an inventory row. Where I was sitting back there, on my throne of contempt. Where I was sitting, I could see or feel something about these people. There was just something about them. I didn't know what it was. It's not issues you come through the door. They don't issue that. That is only given to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are out there giving a little just for the hell of giving it. Who are out there driving 185 miles to meetings to carry the message to people who don't want to hear about it. Who don't care. People like me who come to scoff and stay to pray. Those are people. They had this twinkle in their eye and they smile on their face and they seemed to walk with this air of peace about them because they were giving a little for the hell of giving it. They were doing what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was designed to do. I didn't know that. They talked about God that morning. I left. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you talked to me about God, I left because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. See, when you run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for your dilemma, you can always blame God for it. Sure, it's God's fault. Listen, you can hear about it. You can hear about it all the time. Well, I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. I'll tell you how I feel about that. Next time you get hungry, you go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. If God squirts you one through the keyhole, you call me. Man, I'll be on the next plane east. I'll tell you about this. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a long, long time. I'm a long way from being a very godly person, but I do know one thing about God. One thing and one thing only. God will not do anything for me that I can do for myself. Nothing. And I'll tell you why I know that. There's only been one single thing in my entire life that I have never been able to do. One thing, or one thing only. I wasn't able to do it before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't been able to do it since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I won't be able to do it from this day forward. Of myself and by myself, I cannot keep from taking a drink of alcohol. Isn't that amazing? Now, for over 28 years of my life, I haven't taken a drink of alcohol, swallowed any mood-changing chemicals, smoked any funny cigarettes, or stuck any needles in mine. From the first moment I saw you to this very instant, I haven't had any of that stuff in my system. And what even blows my mind even more than that is I haven't had a conscious thought or a conscious desire to put any of it in my system from the first instant I saw you to this moment. Now, that doesn't make me wonderful. All that goes to show me is how sick I am. Because my God seems to understand that I can't harbor a thought in my head for over 30 seconds without putting it into action. And if I was to dwell on taking a drink, I would take one. If I thought it would work, I'd probably take one. Real simple. I was a long way from that. I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and long enough, one day I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous till God sent one of his angels to me. And you know what an angel is? An angel is a messenger of God. That's all. He's a messenger. He's not God, he's just a messenger. And I'm going to tell you, I've had some of the homeliest looking angels in my life come to me. Really. This little guy was about that high. He did 23 flat years in the penitentiary. He used to be my baseball coach when I was the star second baseman for the San Quentin Pirates. Put that on your resume sometime, Charlie. He stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me something that all the great learned people who sit and interviewed me in my lifetime didn't seem to know. He stood at a podium like this a long time ago on a Sunday morning. He told me the thing I'd been waiting all my life for somebody to tell me. He told me I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. He said, "You don't have to do it like this no more." And after the meeting, I went up to him. I said, "How do you learn how to live, lad?" He looked at me and he smiled. He said, "Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. You go get that book. I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it." I guess he prayed real hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all of society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. There's a strange phenomenon that takes place in my life, and I'd like to share that with you. It seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to have a lot of trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not an alcoholic. And I was an alcoholic. You proved to me I was an alcoholic. I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess you confused me more than anybody had ever confused me in my life before I came here. I sit in your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people would get up at podiums like this and say, "I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful." I say, "I'm not an alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I'm as physically sober as he is, and I'm nuts." The logical explanation is, I'm not alcoholic. God, I wish I was an alcoholic. If I could just be an alcoholic, all I would have to do is not drink. If I was just an alcoholic, all I'd have to do is not drink. And then I'd hear you say things like, "You got to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous." I'd get up and run around like a chicken with my head cut off. But I picked up ashtrays. I smiled at people. I said, "Wonderful, don't you love it here in AA with us?" I went back and sit in the corner back there where I lived and died. I'm doing everything you told me to do. I'm still crazy. So I'd say, it's logical. I'm not alcoholic. See, if I was an alcoholic, all I would have to do is pick up these damned ashtrays and not drink, and I'd be wonderful, like they are. But see, there's something wrong with me. And then every time I ask somebody, they say, "Oh, it's in the book, Johnny." "What's in the book?" "Oh, it's there."
If you just look for it, you will find it. It's in that book. They tell you things like, the answer to any question you may ever have in your lifetime lies between the covers of the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they'd wander off into it. I thought I'd show you. I'll work your steps. Prove to you I'm not alcoholic. You say it won't fail, I'll prove you it will. Somewhere sitting in a room with a man taking my fifth step. A long time ago, I heard myself admit to him that I was an alcoholic. I don't know where it came from. It started way down deep inside of me, and it came out with me, and with it, there came a freedom that I carry with me to this very instant. Because I know what I am. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. Alcoholism. Not alcoholisms. Isms. Some people seem to think it's wasms. You know, I don't drink, so it wasms. I'm restless and irritable and discontent. I didn't know that was symptoms of my illness. That's the way I always was when I was sober. I found out in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a chapter called There Is a Solution. In that chapter, it says a man armed with these facts can live a peaceful, productive life. I didn't know that. I just know that I walked out of that man's office that day, and for the first time in my life, I heard the birds singing. And I've been free ever since, and I was still in the penitentiary. On June 4th, 1961, they turned the doors open and let me out of the penitentiary. But prior to that, some people of Alcoholics Anonymous took it upon themselves to help me. It's funny how these people come into your life and want to help you after you try to help yourself, I suppose. Because they set me in rooms. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my vocabulary consisted of four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere, kind of a trigger that made it go. And people would say to me things like, cussing is a crutch for conversational cripples. And then they'd say, we don't say it that way, Johnny, we say it this way. And then they'd stand my wrath when I rained on them. But you see, they loved me. They were more concerned about saving my life than they were about hurting my feelings. I get a kick out of that sometimes. I went to a meeting not long ago, and a guy said to me, he said, are you going to talk about God? And I said, yes. He said, oh, you may run the new people out of here if you talk about God. I'm going to tell you something. If God will run you out of Alcoholics Anonymous, whiskey will run your rusty butt back in here. That seems to be the great common denominator. You don't have to worry about violating rules here. Whiskey will take care of it. People worry about all this kind of stuff going on, about this and that, violation of tradition, blah, 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 blah. It says in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, whiskey, alcohol is a great enforcer. And if it ain't enforced you yet, it will. I guarantee you that. It will bring you to your knees. It'll kill you, destroy your brain, or make you willing to do the things that's necessary to stay here. And I guess I was willing to do something to stay here. Because I walked out of that penitentiary in 1961 on June the 4th into a world I didn't know anything about. I went home to see my mother that day, and it was on a Sunday, and she fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. I'd like to be able to stand here and tell you my mother's sober, but I don't know that for sure. My mother's sober. She goes to meetings when she doesn't drink. But she drinks between the meetings. It's kind of hard to tell Mom. You know, my mother's got a perfect excuse. Perfect excuse. Man, you talk about denial. My mother's 80-some years old and she drinks whiskey out of half pints because alcoholics drink them out of pints. My mother says to me when I say to her, Mom, you got to go to Amy. She says, looky here, Buster. My name's not Buster, but Mom doesn't know that. She points to, she says, it was me who come to the nut house to visit you. And if you ever have to come to the nut house to visit me, then I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's your old city. See, I learned a great lesson from my mother. After 27 years of watching my mother go in and out, I've learned a great lesson. I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get anybody drunk either.
What power do I have? I have the book says I'm powerless. If I'm powerless, that doesn't mean I have any power. I'm powerless. I've got a daily reprieve from alcoholism. That means I got right now. That means I don't get paid off for the 28 years and some odd months I've been hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous doing what I'm asked to do around here. That means I get paid off today to get to stay sober today because I was willing to come to Flint, Michigan and share my experience, Drink with Hope and Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to stay sober another day. I get to stay sober another day because sitting in a penitentiary a long, long time ago, I said to myself, if they allow me the privilege to go sit in their meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll do anything they ask me to do. Anything. And that's one thing that I have never backed off from in all my days in Alcoholics. I do whatever I am asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. When Jack called me and wanted to know if I'd come to Flint, I said, the date's open, it belongs to you, Jack. The date's open. I didn't ask him if it was Christmas, Thanksgiving, or my birthday, or my anniversary, or anything. If the date's open, it belongs to you because, you see, every day I live is Christmas. This is Christmas. This is the 4th of July. This is my birthday. This is the beginning of a whole new world for me today. Because I woke up this morning and I wasn't sick and I wasn't locked up. I got a chance, and when I get on an airplane this afternoon, I'll go back home and I'll get in my car and I'll drive in my house and I'll sit down in my house. And there's a woman in my house who loves me, and my house. I work. I pay the rent. I become self-supporting through my own contribution. I think that's a big joke, but I wouldn't be able to stay sober if I didn't do that. Somehow or other. You see, when I came out of that penitentiary, I didn't know anything about living in the world. And my sponsor told me I had to go to work. I had one of them hard-hearted sponsors. He said, you have to go to work. And I said, what? He said, work. W-O-R-K. Yeah, they just had to kind of feed me little things at a time to get through this keen alcoholic mind of mine. Have you ever noticed that the only people who talk about the keen alcoholic mind are alcoholics? Non-alcoholics don't talk about the keen alcoholic mind, okay? You call up one of them and say, oh yeah, the guy with the keen alcoholic mind? Yeah. He got up and peed in the dresser last night. If I was that much smarter, I'd be dead now. That much. The old guy used to tell me, you can't think your way into right living, John. You got to live your way into right thinking. You got to live your way into right thinking. And see, that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous did. They taught me how to live. I didn't know how. My sponsor got me a job in oil field. I showed up. By this time, my wife had come back. She got this little girl I was never supposed to see. She's going to have another one. I thought it was time to go to work. I showed up at a job in the oil field. And the guy said, what's your Social Security card number, kid? And I said, what? He said, Social Security card. And I said, what's that? He said, you don't have a Social Security card? And I said, no. He said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 30. He says, you don't have a Social Security card? And I said, no. And he said, why not? I said, I've never needed one. He said, where have you been all these years? I said, you wouldn't understand if I told you, mister. You know what he did? He took me, I got my Social Security card and put me to work. So I couldn't go home and tell my sponsor. They didn't hire an ex-convict out there. They didn't have a chance. Then I had to try and figure out what they did when they got paid. You ever watch what they do when they get paid? You know what they do? They go to the market. They do. They go home, they get the kids and the wife, they put them kids in them baskets backwards and push them up and down the aisle of the market. I used to stand over there in the corner and watch them. You know? And so I finally got a paycheck and I ran home. I told this woman, I said, let's go to the market. She said, what for? I said, well, that's what they do when they get paid. She said, who? And I said, them. Did you ever try to explain them to a non-alcoholic? Huh? Have you ever tried? Yeah, they're out there. Who's out there? You can't explain them to them. You know what I mean? But I guess I had one of those serene, wonderful alcoholic looks in my eyes, like, "We go to the market, bitch, or I'm gonna kill you." Because we're just so wonderful and spiritual when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly in the meetings, you know, so godly. We went to the market. I put the kid in the basket backwards, ran up and down the market aisles and filled it up full of groceries. We went home and I was just proud. I asked her for some money to get a haircut and somebody stole her purse. You want to hear somebody scream? Listen to the thief when they get stolen from. Well, I ranted and raved and hollered and jumped. And I tell you, if I could have caught that guy, you'd have another talker here this morning. I tell you that. I'd be up there in Folsom telling you, AA don't work. When I finally got through, I sat down. She poured me a cup of coffee. She says, "You all through?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Now you know how it feels." See how cruel they were to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous? I was sensitive, just as sensitive as you new people are. They don't care. I went back to work that afternoon. 2 weeks later, I got another paycheck. Isn't that amazing? You go to work, they give you a paycheck. It's just a funny thing they do out there. You work, they give you money. It's just, I've been working for, geez, time to retire. I've been working 26, 7 years, for Christ's sake, out there getting paycheck. And I just stand here before you this morning. This is the honest to God truth. I've got everything in the world man could possibly ever want. Everything. I've got everything in life I want, really. I live where I want to live. I do what I want to do. I'm married to who I want to be married to. I live in a place I've always wanted to live in. I drive an automobile I've always wanted. I have a little job that paid me enough money to make a decent living. It's amazing. And all I've had to do is just come to meetings and show up at meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous and do what I'm asked to do. It's on. And that doesn't mean that every day I've lived out there, I've been walking down the sunny side of the street. It doesn't mean that at all. Well, I've been through just about everything you could be. When I was 5 or 6 years sober, my first wife committed suicide. I don't know how to handle that. I got mad about it. Sit in meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous, angry. See, I've always had a knowledge in the back of my head. If I just sit in meeting, just go sit in meeting. When I get down in the mouth and things aren't going well, I sentence myself to 90 meetings in 90 days. I just go sit in meetings. There's something about sitting in meetings, somewhere in there, the problem is removed. You see, the problem is always me. Always me. It's never anybody else. It's never their fault. It's always me. I become selfish. I become self-centered. I become self-serving. When I'm 5 or 6 years sober, I was more interested in material things than I was in spiritual things. I was more interested in how I looked out there than how I was in here. And I had to have tremendous blows to my ego to get me back on the track again. Because I'm selfish and self-centered and self-serving and self-seeking. That's the way I am. That doesn't end because I don't ingest alcohol into my system anymore. That's the monster that lays underneath my skin. I like to put it like this. The beast may be caged, but the door is unlocked. And these lobbies spring forth at any moment. If you don't believe that, you ought to see me on the freeway sometime. It's amazing to me. It's amazing to me the things that happened to me. Hell, I've been through business failures. You know, I've had kids on drugs. Well, one kid on drugs, my younger daughter. I've been through divorce. I ended a 20-year marriage 4 or 5 years ago. Divorced. I just had about all kinds of things. And I have never quit going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never sat around and tried to defend my mistakes. I don't think there's anything wrong with making mistakes. I think people get drunk because they try to defend them. That's why I think people get drunk. They're trying to defend their mistakes. You make a mistake, you make a mistake. So what? That's life. You see, I'm just basically a human being. That's all.
What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is just made me a basic human being. That's all. Nothing else. And everybody that I know and everybody that knows me knows there's just one simple thing in life that I love to do. I love to play golf. And a few years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a country club, a very exclusive country club. And one day I'm out there playing golf with some doctors, and I'm walking down the fairway, and I got a short-sleeved shirt on. On my arms, I got things like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them. Little panthers with their sides shot out. They're just little conversation pieces in the coffee shop, I'll tell you that. You ought to see them. Were you in the Navy? No, I wasn't. They think everybody got a tattoo is in the Navy. It's a good thing I don't take my shirt off. They'll know I wasn't in the Navy there, I'll tell you. Anyhow, I'm walking down the fairway with this little doctor, and he says to me, "Gee, John, you have big forearms." And I says, "Yes." And he says, "Did you ever play baseball?" I said, "Every time I went to jail." You know how they are, little. You've never been in jail. I didn't tell them any different. It's never been my thing. That's never been one of my things. I used to be bad and I'm wonderful, but you're bad because you've never been bad. I've just never been my thing. I'm kind of glad, because over a period of years, a little doctor, I've grown to love him a great deal, and he told me his story. See, his story was that he was a little Jewish orphan in the Bronx in New York. And he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without, and he took himself out of that orphanage. And then he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without, and he put himself through college. And then he worked, and he studied, and he sacrificed, and he did without, and he became a doctor. And he joined the country club, and he plays golf on Wednesdays. He did that. I have no way of telling him that I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the streets, in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses. I got sober and ended up in the same place he did. And you know the reason I can't tell him is because he don't believe me. He won't believe me because he lives by society's rules, I suppose, that you have to work, study, and sacrifice, and self-sacrifice, better yourself, get something, be something. You know, when I quit trying to get anything, I've been given it all. You know, they say you're supposed to go somewhere. You know, when I quit trying to go anywhere, I've been all over the world. When I quit trying to go anywhere, no one's going anywhere. It's hard to believe sometimes when these people, when they talk to you about this, that I used to ask the old timers when I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, what is this thing? What is sobriety? What's it all about? Where'd it come from? I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for this good life that I had. And they said to me things like, "Your sobriety, John, is a gift from God." Being the type of person I was all my life, I always wanted to know what I gave God in return. Of course, you see, I didn't want to owe God anything. "What do I do for God?" they said. They said to me this, "Johnny, what you do with your sobriety would be your gift to God." My sobriety is the most priceless thing that I possess. I treasure it above all things. I do nothing to put my sobriety in jeopardy. Nothing. I live nowhere contrary to the teachings of this program to the best of my ability one day at a time. I treasure it above all my treasures. If my sobriety, or what I do with my sobriety, would be my gift back to my loving Father God, I would only live with one thought and one thought only for as long as I live. I would only pray that my loving Father God has been as pleased with my gift to Him today as I've been with his for 28 years. Thank you.
Thanks, Johnny. Now, I got one job I'm going to give away. That's the nice thing about being program chairman. And that's one I'm glad I don't have to do. And that's close up this conference. I'll bring Lloyd up, conference chairman.
Hi, everybody. I'm some kind of an alcoholic, and Lloyd Hosner's my biggest problem. You know, we had people wondering, why the hell are we bringing a speaker all the way from California? Now you know. I want to satisfy some of your curiosity. Some of you don't give a damn. I'm going to tell you anyway. I'm going to throw some figures at you. You know, Friday morning, we wondered if we was going to make expenses even pay for this damn thing. We ended up with 825 registrations. And you don't know it, but you drank $4,500 worth of coffee. We just paid the hotel part of the bill. The treasurer wrote him a check for $7,500. We have some to pay yet. The bills will come close to $9,000. Now, you wonder where your 12 bucks went to. Part of your 12 bucks went to pay that. Now, you know alcoholics. They get sobered up, they get short arms and long pockets. And we had people come in and they said, 12 bucks, you know? Hell, I don't drink 12 bucks worth of coffee. But that's what it amounts to. And I don't know about you, but I think this conference has been a success. I feel like I got a lot of weight off my shoulders right now. Some of the meetings we had organizing this thing, especially when we wanted to throw Jack Burks out, because Jack said, we're going to do it this way. And I said, the hell we are. I'm the chairman of this thing. You're just a program chairman. And he would leave in a huff, you know, I ain't coming back. But right now, it's all cool. Russ is like, John said, it's cool. I turned my collar up and I put my shades on. Cool. This thing is over. And I am lucky. I don't know. I feel like when I'm in a conference, sometimes I'm in a cocoon, you know. I'm protected here. But tomorrow is Monday. And we got to go back out into this world. It's over. Some of you are going to have a letdown. I've seen this happen. Don't let it happen to you. I've seen some aspects of letdown, but the only thing that will help is a drink. God, don't do it. Let's close this with a large prayer.
Our Father.